You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Tonight, our topic is the intriguing one of The State and the Stork. That's taken from the title of our guest's new book that explores the population debate and policymaking in U.S. history. On the phone with us now is Derek Hoff, who's a political and economic historian at Kansas State University. Welcome, Derek Hoff.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Hi, Susan.
Yes, great. We have you going across the lines here, so we're good to go.
Wonderful.
In the introduction to your book, Derek, you say that, and I quote, a surprisingly large and varied number of Americans have perceived population trends as snakes in the garden. Please explain that statement and how it led to your book. Which garden are we talking about? What snakes?
Well, I get, no one's ever asked me that, so I had to think about it. But I guess the garden would be Americans' economic prosperity and environmental health, and perhaps the sense Americans have that they have almost a right to almost unlimited natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the garden. I think the snakes would be various perceived demographic problems. Most often the fear that the population is growing too rapidly and will get too big. Sometimes, especially during the 1930s, the Great Depression, the fear of losing population. And of course, throughout the nation's history, there's been this fear that the wrong kind of people with the wrong color skin mm-hmm. are coming to our shores.
Let's also emphasize for our listeners that we're talking about American history here. Some global issues will come in, but your book is principally only about American history.
Yeah, largely. And I write a surprisingly large number of Americans have perceived these problems. And that's really why I bought the book, because it's why today, I think, this show aside and, some other commentators aside, there's very little talk about population growth in the United States. Even though the Census Bureau projects a population of 439 million in 2050 and nearly 600 million in the year 2100. And yet just 40 years ago, as a lot of listeners will remember, there was a widespread zero population growth movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when America had 200 million people, and they were calling for, population stabilization. So in large measure, the book is an attempt to explain this disappearance of the population issue in the last generation.
Maybe you could just give us a little background. You talk early in the book about how attitudes toward population, social attitudes, economic and political, have fluctuated over the times, and part of it mm-hmm. has to do with color and economy and so forth. But could you just kind of tell us about some of the major theories about population that you look at over a big chunk of time?
Sure, and I found there's really been very little to the debate in the last couple hundred years. I mean, it's the same. You can get the same editorials today. Essentially, there's three major positions. There's what I'll call the Malthusian position, and I'm sure most of your listeners know who Thomas Malthus was, the British pastor who right around 1800 predicted that eventually population would outstrip natural resources and lead to calamity. So Malthusians, of course, want fewer people, and they believe that there'll be a population-induced natural resource crisis if we don't reduce our populations. The opposite of that, of course, is what I'll call the Chamber of Commerce view, mm-hmm. The railroad booster view in the 19th century, the traditional American view that more is bigger, is better, and you can't have enough people because they're wonderful and they're great for the economy.
Right.
And a third one, which I try to give a lot of attention to in the book because it's not as discussed today, this is the idea that population growth really affects and perhaps harms the quality of life in the United States. That, maybe we'll have enough food to feed ourselves for another, 500 million people, but what are we giving up in terms of a quality of life, in terms of the ability to go and find solitude in the wilderness, to enjoy quiet? And so some of those kind of softer quality of life concerns were really important in the middle of the 20th century, and they've really fallen by the wayside.
So that's different from the Malthusian view in that it really isn't a crisis situation that is the concern, but just the good qualities that we can have if there just aren't so many people.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the reasons the Malthusians have probably, not been winning the last 40 years is they've sort of forgotten some of those points, which I think resonate more with Americans than simply scare tactics and incorrect predictions of, mass starvation.
Mm-hmm.
Americans are very used to a wide-open lifestyle. We have big overstuffed houses and oversized lots. And, tying population into some of that traditional sense that America's a wide-open nation has been quite effective when used.
So as a, you're talking about as a means to control population growth. You use this approach as opposed to a scare tactic.
Well, I don't mean to be cynical, and I try not to give recommendations to any side. I try to be neutral in the book. I'm just saying, you know, those are important concerns, and they resonated with people really throughout the 20th century. You know, when Presidents Kennedy and Johnson talked about things like beauty and how population growth was the enemy of beauty. And you just don't hear that today because, you know, the debate is very much about CO2 levels. And these are very, very important topics. Obviously, we're facing, you know, major environmental problems. But so you sometimes hear some of the less of the kind of softer aesthetic or quality of life aspects of population growth in the environment.
I did want to ask Derek Hoff about your use of the term Malthusian. I noticed that you use it all the way to the end of the book, but surely there must be a big shift in the Malthusian position since Thomas wrote his essay in 1798. I was interested, for example, that you call Paul Ehrlich the population bomb author who alerted a lot of people in the latter 20th century to population issues, but you link him sort of with a Malthusian point of view, but that seems to me, frankly, a little bit of a stretch given changing views of overpopulation.
Well, but I think it's basically fair in the sense that he argued that too many people would lead to a natural resources crisis.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think at root, that's fair. Now, clearly, in fact, many Malthusians hate just sort of being lumped in with Thomas Malthus because our level of knowledge is a lot more sophisticated than it was in 1800, particularly about environmental change. I mean, Thomas Malthus was all about food and calories.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, even Ehrlich didn't say this is literally, will we have enough calories to feed the world? You know,
right.
Malthus wrote before modern ecology took off.
Mm-hmm.
So Malthusianism in the 20th century took on a much more ecological bent to it, and it got a lot more sophisticated about environmental analysis as opposed to just sort of, you know, food count, I would
right.
say.
Okay, good. It's good to have that clarification as we proceed.
We'd like to go back in American history and look at what the founders thought about population, and how did that evolve in the early years of the Republic?
Great. I love talking about the founders, even though I was sort of pretending as a 20th century historian it was a crash course in them to write that chapter.
It's fun, though.
But, it's just like the debate today. The founders were all over the map on population. A lot of them took pride in the remarkable population growth of the colonies, and the colonies always had fantastic population growth, except for the first few years of the death trap in Roanoke and Virginia. Many correctly predicted that population growth would allow America to be strong enough to break free from England. So there's, you know, there's this incredible demographic pride. But on the other hand, many founders, even before the founding of the United States, you know, back in the 1740s, 50s, and 60s, they believed even then that what defined America was its wide open lands and its relatively unpopulated state, you know, putting Native Americans unfortunately aside, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So they feared that if the American population grew too much and grew too rapidly, that America would in fact become like Europe, because they associated Europe with overpopulated, teeming societies that were old and corrupt and vice-ridden. And in particular, what happened, they believe, when you had too many people was you had to build giant cities. And you had to build industry to employ all those people. You had to have factories. Whereas a lot of American founders, especially Jefferson, wanted America to remain agricultural.
Right.
And so they feared that population growth would turn America away from the farm and toward the cities. Now, Jefferson famously said that, you know, there'd be land enough for 1,000 years. And so they debated sort of when this shift would happen. But they all basically agreed, and after Malthus printed his essay, they all basically agreed with the idea that too many people was a problem. They may have suggested, you know, it wouldn't be a problem yet in the United States. But at root, they all agreed with the Malthusian idea that too many people would impoverish society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Thomas Jefferson, of course, was hugely influential in that sort of discussion. His theoretical approach was hugely influential.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, he is, most historians credit him with sort of being what we would call a population optimist, that there'll be enough land and we'll keep America young.
Mm.
And yet, he was so obsessed with keeping America agricultural. And at root, it was a Malthusian idea. He very much thought that if you had to sort of prevent the ills of overpopulated European cities. Madison, in particular, basically said we're all doomed if the population grows too much. He was a lot more stark than Jefferson ever was.
Right.
It really seems astonishing that they had that concern so early in the game. Malthus wrote in 1798, and we're going to ask you to cover huge periods of time tonight, but what went on with population growth and theory during that first century of the New Republic? And let's leave slavery out of the question for the moment.
Sure. And, you know, it's amazing. The first census recorded 4 million people in the United States,
yes. Mm-hmm.
1790. And I don't even know what it is today. I'm not one of those people that checks the Census Bureau page every day. Well, again, I don't want to say that the publication of Malthus didn't move the debate that much, but it really didn't. The debate was already there. And, you know, in the first few decades of the 19th century, again, many Americans said Malthus might have a logical point, but it probably wasn't applicable to the wide open and young United States. Mm. And others, you know, quite quickly started to argue that population growth was going to be the snake in the garden. And, of course, there were some, the Whig Party in particular, it was centered on the East Coast. They articulated kind of a modern Chamber of Commerce view, you know, the more people, the better, it's good for the economy and leads to liberty and all those kind of arguments.
And how did slavery and Africans intersect with the issues of population?
Yeah, this was probably the most fun to research because I knew the least about it. And I had no idea the degree to which demographic concerns and population was woven into every aspect of the slavery debate. And it gets complicated, but just to sort of touch on a couple highlights. First, there's the demographic debate about the growth of slavery itself. And that's because slave populations were able to sustain themselves much better than many parts of the New World, when slavery was even more awful and brutal. Mm-hmm. And the fact that slaves could keep themselves populated, this horrified Northerners who were worried about losing power to the South.
Yes.
Right, and its population growth. It also horrified many people who were anti-slavery, but still incredibly racist. And, of course, most people who were anti-slavery were still incredibly
sure.
racist.
Mm-hmm.
They feared the eventual free black population would grow too fast. On the other side of the coin, there was a debate about how slavery affected the white population. So here, this is a way that some Southerners could carve out an abolitionist argument, because they said that slavery was stunting the growth of the white population. It was stunting immigration, and literally you got these arguments that, you know, whites were lazy because of slavery. And so many white Southerners feared losing demographic power to the North if slavery remained. But then again, many Southerners also used Malthus to make pro-slavery arguments. And this is perhaps the most fascinating and bizarre. But essentially the argument was, among many pro-slavery Southerners, was that, well, abolition is just not necessary. You don't have to worry about slavery because they're going to die out. Because what's going to happen is that slavery, there are going to be too many slaves, and they're eventually going to overwork the land, and there's going to be a Malthusian crisis because of the growing population. And then kind of magically, like a poof, slavery will go away. Essentially, don't worry about it, Northerners. This will kind of grow, you know, in a grisly manner, take care of itself, but it's not a problem. You know, President Lincoln came close to articulating this kind of argument about the eventual demise of slavery. Mm-hmm. And then finally, and I'm sorry if I'm going on here, but the last fascinating thing is that population projections were at the center of the debate about westward expansion of slavery mm-hmm. and popular yes. sovereignty. And some argued that sending slaves to the distant territories would be great because it would perhaps, quote, civilize slavery and maybe make it less important. And then again, it would kind of magically die out as slaves became a smaller percentage of a population of any particular county. Others argued that slavery would come to dominate the entire nation if it expanded geographically and hence demographically. So again, it was demographics were at the absolute center of the slavery debate.
Yeah.
One of the things we appreciated about your book is the complexity of the arguments that you offer. There are no one-to-one correspondence, as you've just demonstrated. You can find arguments on both sides of the abolition question among Malthusians and among Chamber of Commerce type boosters.
And thank you, you know, for saying that. And maybe that's a time to make the point that in some ways population is often a political football. It's often something that people with other interests talk about. You know, we see that today when anti-immigration folks, who I would call cultural nationalists, they want America to remain white,
right?
And they'll use arguments about overpopulation. So many people have come to the population issue because that was their main issue. Others have kind of, you know, dipped into demographic arguments when expedient throughout U.S. history.
And you trace the birth of the modern debate to the late 19th century. So we're talking about sort of at the end of the slave period and
yes.
then to pre-World War II. How did the issue change during that period of time? And it, both in the popular press or in the popular mind and among economists?
Sure. Well, right around the turn of the 20th century, I think we basically see the population debate. I hate to say it because, again, we've talked about how the idea has changed, but almost as it looks today, which is you've got the emergence of economists that are very pro-population growth, that are making all the arguments about how population growth is boosting consumption and investment and is good for optimism and good for the economy. You're also getting a lot of economists that are articulating the traditional Malthusian view, kind of updated with economic theory, that too many people is not only bad for natural resources, which we talked about, but that it just drives down wages too much.
Yeah.
It makes people poor. It creates a glut of workers. One of the great ironies of today's population debate is that many conservative economists embrace population growth. They see it as a kind of unmitigated economic good. Mm-hmm. And they also sort of celebrate what are called the classical economists of the mid to late 19th century. Ironically, a lot of these economists in the 19th century actually agree with Malthus on the question of population. So even though many conservatives today support these economists on just about everything else, they've kind of dropped their fear of population growth. So, you know, right at the turn of the century, we're already seeing kind of what I would call the modern camps in terms of pro-population growth and anti-population growth. And then to jump all the way to the 1930s, things get complicated by the arrival of John Maynard Keynes, who kind of completely revolutionized economic theory and the emergence of Keynesian economics, which emphasizes the benefits of mass consumption. And I'm sorry, you should cut me off here because I could talk about the 1930s for an hour.
No, but I think you should talk about maybe not an hour. But tell us about the 1930s and how Keynes's theories.
I will, and thank you and for asking what is often, you know, the kind of driest topic. But the 1930s are so fascinating because for a time, and this proves, by the way, that demographic projections are often wrong, which is one of the arguments today against Malthusians, right? Take care of itself. Projections are wrong. But in the 1930s, many demographers predicted a depopulation of the United States. Basically, people weren't having babies because of the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And the trend since 1800 had been to have fewer babies, and it was just accelerating. So they talked about a population today of like 175 million as opposed mm-hmm. to 310 million.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, some people responded to that with an obvious argument, which is, oh, okay, the economy is not doing well, the population growth rate is down, we need more babies, and that'll grow the economy. And again, that reinforced that traditional Chamber of Commerce view.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, at the same time, many people took the new Keynesian theory, which was stressed the importance of mass consumption, and they actually grafted that onto Malthusian ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, what is important to the economy is not growing sheer bodies. It's not a body count. What matters is that per capita consumption per person. So they argue that what we need to do is retool our economy so that everybody gets more of the pie, and you don't need a growing population if you do that. And so you can have all the benefits of economic growth without any of the environmental problems of too many people. And this idea of kind of grafting Keynesian economics, stress on mass consumption, with the traditional fear of population growth really dominated from like the 1930s to the 1970s.
Interesting.
We had one. We want to jump fairly soon to the baby boomers in the post World War
mm-hmm.
II. But as we mentioned to you, we're particularly interested in eugenics, which figured prominently in the early 20th century and is
yes.
still kind of alive and much too well today, in our opinion. Could you talk about the eugenics movement, maybe link it to Malthusianism and other concerns about population growth?
Yeah, may I turn it back on you for a second? Where do you see eugenics still lingering today?
Oh, I think there's a lot of talk about people from south of the border coming over, and if our numbers continue to
mm-hmm.
increase in the cities, the white population will decrease and we'll have a majority of the population speaking Spanish. Then, heaven forbid, English would not be our only language.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I write a lot about what I call the ghost of eugenics, because, of course, people can't make the arguments
yes,
in the 1920s,
yes, right.
But it's still very much out there in the popular culture.
Okay,
and, in
good,
fact,
yeah.
you will hear college kids say, you know, stupid people should not breed. I mean, you will hear
right.
those kind of
yes.
post-eugenic arguments.
Yes.
But, as I guess we've touched on, eugenics was obviously the twisted idea of breeding a better population, which meant encouraging births among the so-called genetically fit, which of course usually meant white people with good incomes, and discouraging births among the so-called genetically unfit, which of course was often people of color or people with disabilities, et cetera. And this idea, of course, at root was obviously came from Darwin. And the origins of species, and then took a few decades, you know, and it sort of filtered through social Darwinism, the idea that Darwin's ideas were applicable to societies. And the eugenics movement really took off, also some rediscovery of certain science and early genetics was important for this. And it took off in England. It was very much a transatlantic movement, but then it came over to the States, and it was very important in the 1910s and 1920s. And it petered out in the 1930s. Historians debate this. Some would argue that, of course, the specter of Nazism and Hitler's race ideas really dealt a death blow to eugenic thought. Others would suggest, you know, it just kind of retooled. 1920s eugenicists became 1950s marriage counselors.
But for, God.
That's been a sort of, it's actually a pretty effective argument. But what the eugenics movement did, it did have some success. I say in my book, maybe not as much as we suggested, and perhaps Americans are too quick today to sort of see a eugenicist behind everything when in fact it was just a garden variety racist, because Americans were plenty racist before the eugenics movement came along. But eugenics' main success were the very, very nasty sterilization laws in just about every state, which led to the sterilization of probably 60 to 70,000 people deemed unfit in institutions and sometimes quasi-voluntarily, which went on really until the 1970s and sometimes the 1980s. And then, of course, the 1924 Immigration Act, which was the important moment when America almost shut its immigration gates to anyone who sort of wasn't white and from Northern Europe, and that would last until 1965. That very much was part of the eugenic discussion. Eugenicists were at the absolute forefront of pushing for the 1924 Immigration Act.
And there have been waves of anti-immigration that maybe can't be characterized as eugenics, but certainly demonstrate the racist attitudes with both Japanese and with Chinese. So all along the way, we've seen this as kind of the being overrun. People in the United States have seen it as being overrun by people who could water us down or affect our language or, decrease what we have ourselves. So, I mean, it maybe can't be characterized as eugenics, but heavily racist. And we see the rise of that again, you know, not just with Latinos, but the white supremacist groups are on the rise and growing.
Okay,
that's a discouraging way to end the segment.
No, yeah, let's not do that. You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Derek Hoff. He's a professor of history at Kansas State, and he's written a book called The State and the Stork, The Population Debate and Policy Making in U.S. History. It's published by the University of Chicago Press, and thank you again for being with us. Okay, let's move on. It is a discouraging way to end a segment. In the first part of the program, you talked about population and policy through the first half of the 20th century. And let's talk about what happened with baby boomers. A lot of our listeners are baby boomers.
Yes, and baby boomers still to this day are front and center of the demographic debate. In fact, you can argue that what's happened in the last 40 years has been a debate about the baby boomers and not about these grand topics going back to Malthus.
Interesting.
So, obviously, as everyone knows, just incredible birth rates in the late 1940s and 1950s, and there's this baby boom. And that, you know, retools the population debate. But again, the historic debate kind of continues. There's the traditional view, the one you see when you open most newspapers today, that babies were simply, you know, great for the economy, part of that boom in the 1950s. You'd see lots of magazine articles like, you know, kids, a built-in recession cure. So this idea that baby boom was linked to the prosperity of the 50s. But, you know, what I try to do in the book is show, and again, this is kind of what historians try to do because this is lost to us today because the debate has gone in a different direction. But many of the economists in the 1950s, you don't get this in a textbook, but if you scratch the surface in the economic field of the 50s, many were quite worried that the American population would not keep up with all the babies. That essentially, like Alice in Wonderland, it would have to run just to stand still. Hmm. That, in fact, sure, you'd have, obviously the overall pie would grow, of course, because you'd have more stuff. But the important question, as it should be, is per capita wealth and happiness. Mm-hmm. Would per capita growth increase? And many economists actually said no, that you would start to see decreasings in standard of living as the population started to grow. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you got more traditional arguments like, you know, we can't build enough schools for all these babies.
And where did all those babies come from? We were talking about it the other day, some of the discussions, the pent-up demand from World War II. But you also talk about the model family, kind of the Leave It to Beaver model of motherhood and child raising.
Yeah, I tend to argue more for the economic than the kind of cultural argument. Some historians have said, well, what really this is about the bomb. That essentially, to be a little bit pat, you know, families kind of retreated into the hearth because they were so fearful of the bomb and the specter of the Soviet Union. So there's this, and we did see this a little bit after 9/11, kind of a retreat to kind of a cult of domesticity.
Right.
I tend to put more of an economic argument because you can almost trace the birth rate with the economy, and I think that's more important. But it's not just that the economy was growing; it was the expectations of people then, which is something we can't understand today in slightly more, you know, pessimistic times. A lot of the mothers of the 1950s and fathers had been kids during the Depression, and many historians have argued that it's comparing, if you're in 1955 and you compare yourself to your parents and how you grew up, it's better, and you feel like things are going to get even better, therefore. So it's not just that you have more money in your pocket, it's that you think things are going to get better. And so it's a psychological explanation, but that's one of the reasons for this kind of optimism that led to starting large families after the war.
And then in the 1960s, in particular, Kennedy and Johnson, the New Frontier, the Great Society, became interested in these issues and became actively involved in a kind of population planning, both in the U.S. and with intent to export our notions abroad. Could you talk about that, please?
Absolutely. And, of course, maybe it's a little bit generous to call Kennedy active. I'd say the Kennedy administration took some baby steps in terms of allowing the State Department to talk about population growth overseas.
I think, again, you said early, that Kennedy, you know, was not that interested in the whole issue, I believe you said.
That's correct. And there's also the kind of lingering Catholic question for Kennedy, et cetera.
Yes.
But, and again, you mentioned earlier, we're talking mostly about the U.S. debate. But, of course, in the 60s, what we're going to see is really the debate become internationalized. And this is the time of the peak growth rates in what, I guess, you know, we still sometimes call the developing world, the third world, et cetera. This is a time when Africa and Asia is non-aligned, you know. So the great question for American policymakers is, how can we prevent the poor people of Asia and India from going over to the Soviet side, you know? So maybe we need to work on population control because that will help modernize and develop them. So there's this big modernization debate. So the Johnson administration is really the key for putting population policy on the domestic and international agenda. And he was quite successful. LBJ was quite successful. He integrated family planning programs into the Great Society. This is a time when family planning was relatively non-controversial. It was not a partisan issue the way it is today.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to see support for domestic family planning programs and clinics where poor women could get family planning. That's part of the Great Society. And then a great acceleration in international family planning programs, aid for population control programs in the developing world. And those, of course, are still the programs that are the great political football, that now it's amazing ritual of the American presidency that the first act is to either reinstate the global gag rule or to get rid of it in terms of what these groups can say about abortion and family planning overseas.
So to what extent do you think these efforts were political? To what extent economic and to what extent social? Or were they just, was that all integrated?
Well, it's funny. Historians have to argue about everything. And so, you know, one person wrote a book saying that these programs were essentially neo-eugenic, that this was simply about rich Westerners arguing that there were too many brown people in the developing world and that we needed to give them family planning programs.
That was my question, actually.
And that's part of it. And I guess I emphasize in the book that a lot of American kind of elites, and these are sort of people like John D. Rockefeller III, who was very big on this issue, that they were genuinely concerned with, A, improving the lives of people in the developing world. It doesn't mean they didn't have racist sentiments, because they certainly did. Most people did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They generally want, they were genuine, generally concerned about the environmental consequences of population growth, particularly in the 1960s, we were beginning to see more ecological arguments. They truly believed, with good reason, I believe, and it's not comfortable to say this now, but there is still good evidence that families with fewer children do better. That you know, it does in fact often lead to getting out of poverty. So that is a debate among historians, how much these things were eugenic and racially motivated. But I think at the time it really was a genuine interest among kind of philanthropically minded people to improve the world.
You also talk beginning in the 70s, about liberal and conservative views of population, and you have some surprising reversals that you discuss there, such as you mentioned earlier, conservatives favoring increased population and liberals themselves being more on the Malthusian side than the cash crop side.
Right, and I think the great moment, and a lot of the book is explaining this, in the sort of politicization of this debate, is right around 1970, 1972. And in the late 1960s, this was still a sort of bipartisan issue. The future 41, George Bush Sr., was a big Malthusian. He has some remarkably Malthusian quotes on the floor of the House in the late 1960s, even had a task force on population. You know, imagine a Republican doing that today. And right around 1970, we're going to see this great kind of pivot toward a politicization in the debate. And the wonderful, for a historian, the wonderful moment that lets me tell this story is Richard Nixon's Commission on Population Growth and the American Future. Kind of a footnote today, but it's this group that Nixon called into being in 1970 to study the population issue. And this is right when the zero population growth movement is peaking in the late 1960s. And this commission is supposed to study the issue. And obviously, it's kind of brought into being with the assumption the population is a problem. And then 2 years later, 1972, the commission reports, but by then Nixon has completely abandoned the population issue. In fact, he's begun to reject environmentalists, reject the population argument. And he basically distances himself from the commission. In fact, he invites them to the White House, but they don't get to sit on the couch or whatever was typical of a commission that you like. And there's some wonderful footage of this. And so what I try to show is that this is the moment when all of the sort of forces leading to the politicization of the population issue really happened. Now, one of these that a lot of historians have emphasized is abortion. You know, Roe v. Wade, of course, is January of 73. Mm-hmm. And abortion is becoming a big issue at the state level right around 1970. So many people, Republican, Democrat, whatever, who were in favor of family planning, this sort of got politicized because all of a sudden now conservatives had to make a choice, and many considered being pro-abortion kind of too close to the population movement because they correctly saw that many in the population movement were in favor of abortion rights. You're also going to see kind of the peak of the environmental movement, and the kind of waning of the environmental movement is an important part of the story here. But what I really focus on, again, it goes back to the economic idea, is that in the 1960s, a lot of conservatives switched their position and started to articulate the view that you get today, that you need babies and more people for economic growth. And plenty of conservatives in the early 1960s and mid-1960s did not articulate this view. And that's what I think is so important, that there's this great pivot among conservatives in the 1960s.
And what do you see as motivating that? Capitalism? The need to grow the economy?
Well, I mean, yes. And again, I don't want to suggest that these Chamber of Commerce views had never been there, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And part of it is just sort of the politicization between, you know, we're beginning to see the conservative articulation of a counterattack on the New Deal. I mean, it's not really going to come to fruition until the 70s and 80s. But the 60s are a time when conservatives are essentially building a movement, you know, in universities and in very small think tanks at the time. And they're essentially carving out new positions. And one of those positions is to reject the environmental movement and to reject this idea that population is a problem. Part of it is certainly that the Malthusians overreached in the late 1960s. They, you know, predicted mass starvation. They predicted that there would be a great population calamity around the corner in the United States. So that's part of the equation, too.
Right. And let's move on. In your closing chapter, you talk about the population aged, the aging population, the grain of the baby boomers.
Yes.
Can you tell us about what you see the issue of population, how you see that relating to aging issues. Social Security, of course, is a huge topic that has to do with we can't cover all these people.
Right. Well, I mean, absolutely. I think it's been front and center since the 1970s. And I try to make the point that the demographics of the baby boom are very important. There's no doubt that America is facing a policy challenge because there's a lot of baby boomers. On the other side of the coin, this was not a non-political stance to call population aging a crisis, you know, the emergence of what I call the aging crisis. This was very much both a response to the Malthusianism of the 1960s and early 1970s. It was another way of arguing, actually, you need more people. Because, if you've got a bunch of people who need to retire, you need more babies to pay for them. So that was part of it. And I think the emergence of an aging crisis paradigm is also very much about welfare state cutting. It's definitely about the politics of retrenchment, to use a kind of European term. Because when you identify aging populations as a problem, that kind of leads to belt tightening. You know, that leads to we've got to make tough cuts in Social Security. And I'm not a policymaker, and there are very real problems, but I do make the point in the book that a society can sort of, you know, put its marbles in whatever basket it chooses to. And there are many, many serious economists who would argue that obviously with a few tweaks on the age of retirement, with different tax policies, that America could clearly afford to remain relatively generous to its aging population. And then, of course, wait for the other side of the demographic mountain when there will be lots of workers and not as many older people. So I guess, like everything else in the book, it became politicized. And I suggest that the idea of an aging crisis is not neutral, that it very much reflected a particular moment in the 1970s of a felt need to cut the welfare state and also this kind of backlash against Malthusianism, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Very close to the end of the book, in your epilogue, I think, you note that, and I'll read the quote, "Emphasis on the aging of the population, however justified by spiraling deficits, has encouraged policymakers to think of babies as future taxpayers rather than as potential environmental or social externalities." We'd like you to explain that statement, but then we have our impossibly broad closing question. What are the kids of the next generation going to think about population, and what are they going to do about it?
Yeah, well, as I always tell my wife, if I could predict the future, I'd be retired by now.
Right.
On the first one, you know, I was struck when last week it was announced, I don't know if you saw it, that it was the year, the warmest year on record in the U.S. by a full degree.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, did you see that?
I didn't see that.
And one of my friends sent me a Wall Street Journal article, and maybe you saw it because it focused on California. And in the same article on the warming United States, it talked about the problem of not enough babies in California and about California's coming demographic crisis tied into its deficits, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that's a roundabout way of saying that there's a real disconnect right now. So you'll see an article on climate change, and at the same time, people will argue about the need to have more babies to grow the economy and pollute more. So I think my quick answer is if we get to a point in society where we have a kind of calm debate about climate change and as a world, I think population will kind of re-enter through the climate change debate, because it's certainly not everything for climate change. Obviously, you have to take into account technology and consumption, et cetera. But, you know, the fact that the world is still growing to 9 or 10 billion is a really important part of that debate. So what will the next generation do and say? I think we are going to see a new population debate. It won't look like it did in 1968, but the fact that America is such a demographic outlier, that so many nations are Western rich nations are expected to see their populations decline or stagnate, which, by the way, is one of the reasons many Americans are shocked that we're going to 600 million, because they turn on the news and they hear about Japan or Italy or Russia, and they don't know what an outlier the U.S. is. And so whenever I talk to people and they say, really, we're going to 600 million? That's really a big story. So I think we're going to see this talked about more and more in the coming years.
The current population clock of the Census Bureau, by the way, clocks us in at 315,167,904. So we're really up to date on
well,
that.
Well, if I told you how few it was when I started the book, you'd be amazed.
Yes. Oh. Right. Yeah, that clock keeps moving. There is also a great deal of concern, I think it's genuine, among baby boomers about leaving the $3 trillion debt to our kids. Do you see that as affecting either the kids' population rate or the willingness of society to reduce deficits to keep things under control?
Well, I mean, again, that's why you have, progressives who will say, the climate change is the problem and we need to do something on population, and they'll write editorials about the need for more babies to pay that bill.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes in the same issue of the Washington Post, you'll see both of those positions. So I obviously don't have a solution for this, and I wish America was not in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that simply a sheer body count is the way to get, any society out of its problem.
Yes.
Right. We've been talking with Derek Hoff. He's the author of The State and the Stork, published by the University of Chicago Press. You can learn more about the book at www.press.uchicago.edu. And you can learn more about Derek and his work at Kansas State University in the History Department at their website. It's www.k-state.edu/history/
Thanks for that plug. Our webmaster will be thrilled.
Yeah, somebody's going.
Well,
you've
got a very strong statement of your own philosophy on the K-State website, which I think people would enjoy reading. Also, listeners, we do have one examination copy of the book that was generously provided to us, and if anybody would like to read the book for free instead of buying a copy and adding to the royalties, we'd be happy to loan it to you. But it's a really fine book, The State and the Stork, full of complexity. We haven't done it justice at all, but thank you, Derek, for doing a tremendous amount of justice to your book and for the work that you do.
Well, thank you for a very enjoyable hour. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Good
night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Lady.
You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. I'd like to make an announcement about the Butte Environmental Council's upcoming puppet-making workshop. This will take place on January the 26th from noon until 5 p.m. at the Habitat Lab. That's at 199 East 13th Street. The puppet workshops are free and open to the public, and they're intended to help people prepare puppets for the Endangered Species Fair that Beck sponsors every May, the first Saturday of May. So that this year it will be May 4th. There'll be three puppeteers there, Jessica McDougall, Kathy Faith. And Cheetah Chudy, and they'll be giving you a variety of ideas for various kinds of puppets, giant puppets, small puppets, and Steve and I will be there giving you some examples of puppet making as well. So come and see us at the Habitat Lab on Saturday, January 26th, 12 to 5.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get where you need to go with EcoCab, the cab that cares. Call them at 591-3186. And we're supported by Electric Canyon Studios and Pro Sound Audio Services, located in Butte Creek Canyon. The studio features contemporary and vintage gear in a professionally designed studio. Operated by audio engineer and musician Dale Price, the studio welcomes artists and bands of any level. Visit electriccanyon.com, that's electriccanyon.com, or call Dale at 343-5265 for more information.
Coming up in just a couple of minutes at 7 o'clock on The Storyteller, Katherine Robinson's theme will be a fun one. Always wear clean underwear and other things your parents tell you and why. She has a great book by Rabbi Mark Gilman that is funny and heartwarming about the things that our folks advised us.
And then at 7:30, host Senior Felipe serves up LA Sounds, taking you back home to the roots where it all began. Back on the Block, come on home with Senior Felipe at 7:30.
And we're happy to spread the word that The Point Is we'll be moving to a new time slot on Wednesdays at 6 p.m., adding greatly to KZFR's public affairs broadcasting. Sue Hildebrand will be hosting the show every Wednesday. This week, she'll be talking about Joe Biden's gun control proposals. Please join her tomorrow night at 6 p.m. And stay as a fan of a wonderful show, The Point Is.
And next week on Ecotopia, we'll be talking with organizers and featured speakers for the upcoming Snow Goose Festival. Please join us. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy.
Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com or visit our website ecotopiakzfr.net. You can also become our friends on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows. Good night. Thanks for listening.